Hi, okay. This is Greg Kelly. Thank you very much for checking out the podcast. I thank all of you, those of you who have written reviews and subscribed and all that stuff. And I thank all of you for thinking about doing the same. And whether you do or not, just thank you for listening. And I hope you find this of value or entertaining and interesting. I really do enjoy this process, talking to people where I don't have to worry about, the next commercial break. Although pretty soon I'm going to start to have to worry about commercials because I've got to start paying for this stuff. But that's fine. That's good. We're going to work that out. Today I'm talking to Larry Kudlow, National Economic Council Director for the President at the White House. Larry is an amazing guy. This is just the latest chapter in a really interesting career. Wall Street, government, television. You may have seen his shows, CNBC. It was omnipresent on CNBC for many years, also on the radio. I first remembered seeing him as a guest on the John McLaughlin show, the McLaughlin Group. And he was, as he calls himself, a regular irregular. So he'd show up from time to time. I was in high school when I first noticed him. And he was like this unapologetic Wall Street swashbuckler. At least that was his demeanor. You know, he looked like a benign Gordon Gekko, you know, with a really cool suit and a haircut. And he was a proud capitalist and a very impressive person. Became very famous in the 80s and 90s. And still is, but let's face it, fame is different now. You can be famous and most people not know who you are. And back then, if you were famous, most people knew who you are or were or whatever. And so when I first met him, maybe 10 years ago, it was pretty cool because I remembered all of these chapters from his career and this kind of landmark profile done on him in the New York Times, where he spoke about some substance abuse issues that he has recovered from, and very likable, charming guy. Everybody likes him, and he's a man of great faith. We talk about that at the end of this podcast. You'll hear a bit of that, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with Larry Kudlow. Larry Kudlow, thank you very much. Great to talk to you again. How are you?
I'm well. I'm still standing. And I've been here almost 3 years, and I'm still going at it.
You know, I saw you going at it yesterday in the driveway of the White House, whatever they call that. You were terrific. The gaggle.
The gaggle.
Right.
The gaggle.
I noticed a reporter was, they were just it was almost like they were badgering you. They were trying to bully you, and they can't bully you. But it occurred to me that the way they were asking questions, they weren't trying to learn anything or inform their audiences. It just looked like they were trying to go viral, to create a confrontation. What did you think of that? I guess you're used to it, but it's still shocking to see sometimes.
Welcome to the White House.
Was it like that when you were first at the White House in the early 80s? I mean, I knew Sam Donaldson was always contentious and stuff like that, but...
No, it wasn't nearly as bad. I mean, I had a lower ranking job, although I was senior staff at the OMB, but I did a lot of media for President Reagan. But no, by the way, Sam Donaldson is a friend of mine. He's a pussycat, but he's a very good reporter, and he's still kicking. But no, it's much more difficult and almost poisonous, Greg.
You know, it seems like also reporters back then in the 80s, they had to know something, and to know something, they had to meet with people, and they had to kind of move around and learn things. And now you have this generation of which, you know, you could be 20, you could be 70, but you can stay in a room with a computer, with a phone, and have all kinds of attitude and come to all kinds of conclusions on your own without engaging the world. I don't know if that makes sense, but I feel like there's a lot of, it's almost like we're all in solitude as we're weighing in on these debates.
Well, I don't think it's a monolithic view. I think that there are some very good reporters, and I also think there are some not so good reporters. And of course, you know, some of them want to make a splash on Twitter or YouTube or something. Others, though, are quite good, well-informed. You know, as a rule, the business and financial and economic reporters, which is my lane, are usually pretty good. Not all of them, but usually pretty good. The political reporters don't know the economic lane all that well. But again, I know some very good ones, and I know some not so good ones. I think on the whole, I've enjoyed pretty good media press relations. You know, I was on that side of the fence for many years. I knew some of them before. I've got to meet a lot recently. So it's a mixed bag. You know, it depends. I don't like blanket assertions. As I say, some are quite good, others not so good.
You know, and one thing that I think you do very, very well, in addition to being obviously a subject matter expert, very few in the country know more than you do, but you're at ease with reporters, you're relaxed with reporters, and you're reasonably accessible. I mean, you have people you report to, or maybe not report to in that, but you have to coordinate with other media people now at the White House. But anyway, that seems to be part of your appeal with the press, because you're still, I think, kind of a favorite of reporters. Fair to say?
Yeah, I think it is. Look, you're very kind. I think, you know, I always start from a good faith position. In other words, let's take yesterday, which was a very long day, jobs day. I think I probably did 4 TV interviews, and I did one. We had a big crowd at the sticks, so-called sticks in front of the White House, the gaggle, very big crowd. And basically, I try to answer their questions. And if it's a loaded question or a pointed question or, you know, a clearly biased question, I still try to answer the substance of the question. And I don't get angry. I don't lose my cool. That's just the way I am. I've spent the better part of the last 3 decades learning to be calm and just do my job. And I think, you know, I think many of them appreciate that. I think even those that have strong disagreements with me or my boss, President Trump, they know that they will get an informed answer. They may not agree with me. I've said that many times. Yesterday I had one reporter, a woman, a political reporter. And I just said to her, I said, look, you may not disagree with our view, but here is our view, since you asked. And I kind of think they appreciate that, you know?
Yeah, I saw the exchange, actually, and you were a gentleman, and it I think you won the exchange, and it fell flat on her part because she was just performing for an audience that wasn't there, not performing them, just performing, and that's rather sad. Larry, can I just ask you, before we get into economics and policy, and I'll tell you in advance, I am more from the political world. I am not a financial reporter by any means. I certainly don't have the expertise. I have some literacy. But what is the mood like at the White House right now? Of course, we don't know who the elector is, who the victor is in that election. I do believe the president won it. But how is it there? What's it like?
Well, I think there's a lot of energy. I mean, look, the president has a lot of energy. We had a meeting yesterday in the Oval, maybe half a dozen of us, on China, and he was very engaged. He was very up to speed. Obviously, he's spending a lot of time right now focused on Georgia, both the presidential votes and, of course, the Senate votes. He's going down to Georgia today to campaign for Perdue and Loeffler, by the way, 2 friends of mine. And I'd say the White House staff, I say the senior staff, this what I call the senior staff, we are number one, doing our job. The business of government goes on. We've got another 50 some odd days. In any event, either he's going to win or he's not going to win. But we National Economic Council, we have a lot of things on the table. We're still, you know, we're working interagency. We're working with governors and senators. I had a prominent governor come in yesterday. And so there's a lot cooking. Probably among the junior staff, a little bit of disappointment. But it's not over till it's over. That's kind of the view. And, you know, I think personally, and I'm very close to the president, and he's been very wonderful to me, just wonderful to me, and so gracious and accessible. I mean, it's really the greatest, greatest honor and greatest job in my professional career, Greg. But he's fighting. You know, he, I think, has every right to argue through the system, the court system, to get at the bottom of this issue of legal versus illegal ballots, among other things. And you saw this, the story from Georgia break yesterday. It's a very strange and sketchy story. So, you know, I admire him. We were together quite a bit two weekends ago. We had the APEC, Asia Pacific Economic Meeting, and on Friday morning to get up at 5 a.m. Not my best moments, but he was there for the 7 o'clock opening, and we had G20 Saturday and Sunday. And, you know, each of these people, leaders, give their messages, and the rest of the time you're kind of just sitting around. But he did it all, and he and I had some great talks. And I recall he said to me at one point, you know, he said, "I've been in deeper holes than this before." So he's got a fighting spirit, and I really admire it. I have no idea how this is going to end. We'll all know probably in a couple of weeks when the Electoral College meets. But I just admire his spirit, and he's as tough as ever. And we're negotiating with the Hill on a so-called assistance package. And he's just totally engaged, Greg, totally engaged. Well, I think that helps the esprit de corps, you know, right down the line.
I'm glad to hear it. I do, strangely, I know people think I'm crazy that this thing, that he can still prevail. And what you just said there resonated with me. If you look at his career, he has been in a lot of deep holes, and some in October of 2016. I mean, that looked unwinnable. People were telling him to drop out. And look what happened. I am just curious about him as a person. I've been around him maybe a dozen times, and I have to tell you, you probably know this, or maybe you've seen this, I'm sure, but he is a very, very different type of person. I have always been positively impressed. He operates differently from most people in a lot of different ways. Can't quite put my finger on it, but he's unlike any individual I ever met. And this is before he became president. There were some things, and that's for another podcast perhaps, that I've seen him do and say. And quick example, I was emceeing an event, and actually was at the Metropolitan Club, and it's bizarre. I introduced somebody who introduced somebody who introduced the president, and he was introduced, and instead of going right to the microphone, he went to the middle of the room where I was. I wasn't on the dais. My job was done. And he said, "You know, Greg, you were just terrific with that guy from the Bronx today. Totally terrific." And then he went up to the microphone and he did his speech, which, you know, I've heard about him flattering people, but it was, when you're about to give a speech, that's the one time you're supposed to think about yourself and nobody else. And that he walked to the middle of the room and said that to me, I found it totally wild. Anyway, do you know what I mean about him being a totally different type of person?
Well, he's, you know, it's so interesting. First of all, he is a very gracious man. When you're working with him, and, you know, I've spent the better part of 3 years, almost on a daily basis, in and out of the Oval or in and out of the back dining room behind the Oval. He is a very gracious man, and he and I can only relate my own experience, but he and I, we agree on most things, but we don't agree on everything. And he loves to have an informed argument. He loves that. And he will cross-examine, and he's very well-read. He is very knowledgeable about so many issues, domestic and foreign. And if you say, you raise your hand, and I mean, I do this all the time, sir, with respect, I just I've got to push back here. We've had some doozies, but he's just so gracious about it. And I'll tell you another thing. First of all, he has a really sharp sense of humor. He really is a businessman becoming president. He's hard charging, very engaged, very hands-on, very, very hands-on. The other thing I'll say is this. You know, he, at least with me, he even did this in the late weeks of the campaign. He'd be out on the stump, and he'd be talking about a bunch of economic numbers. You know, we prepare messages for him, and then he uses it or ad-libs it. And he was saying, I mean, I got reports back. He's saying, like, I know these are right. I know this is a good point because the great Larry Kudlow tells me. Mm-hmm. he says that so many times. And look, Greg, you know, I'm an old veteran. I don't need that. You know, I don't have any ambitions. I did this job. I never looked for another job. Even if he was clearly the winner, I wouldn't have stayed for the second term, although he wanted me to. But that's, he makes those references. And I've seen it with others on the senior staff. People have helped him. It's his way of saying thank you. And he does it in the public. And I've never seen another president do that ever. And I've been around, again, I worked for Reagan, and I've been very close to a bunch of presidents in the last four decades. That's his way of saying thank you. I know you're working hard for me. And again, like, I don't really need that. I mean, it's just not, you know, but it's just him.
Yeah.
It's this graciousness that he has. I'm not sure the public really understands that. He's a really, really top flight person humanly. And I know, you know, some people are turned off by some of the things he says. I get that. You know, he's a fighter from Queens when you dig deep enough. That's what he is. If you hit him, he's going to hit back. But there's this gracious side to him, Greg. And, if I ever do a book, I've written a bunch of books in my time. If I ever do one on the Trump period, I will try to convey that message to readers.
Your books, by the way, are fantastic. You have written a bunch of them. I read, forgive me, only one of them, but I think it's the most recent, and I read it a couple of years ago. Let's see here. JFK and the Reagan Revolution, A Secret
Yeah.
History of American Prosperity. And you do, you know, you're an economist, but you're not writing textbooks here. They're very accessible, I think, to the general public. You did that on purpose, I take it.
I love that book. And yes, of course, because I'm not an academician. I'm speaking to the general public, just trying to convey some ideas with a couple of facts. But I loved writing that book, and I love the JFK Reagan story. I just love it.
Larry,
just to say to your listeners on this, JFK was the first supply side tax cut, and 25 years later, Ronald Reagan was the next one. And there's a clear bridge between the two. People do not remember that John F. Kennedy was a supply side tax cutter who had a terrific economy. A terrific economy. And by the way, the third leg of that is Donald Trump, who slashed taxes and regulations and pre-pandemic had a terrific economy. And even right now, we're recovering in this pandemic situation. So it was a fun book for me to write because almost nobody remembers JFK's economic policy, which was quite good.
And by the way, you talk in that book about how it's an economy that is doing well is an economy that helps people live to their fullest capacities. Like it's healthy for people's spirit. I mean,
yeah.
We all know that
yeah.
We want to, right? I mean, it's just beautifully expressed. And
yeah, that's like a really key point. The country is always, Greg, is always at its happiest when the economy is good and folks are working, you know, and even though we have many, many safety net programs, and you saw we had emergency relief packages when the pandemic hit and the shutdowns crushed the economy. Government is always there as the lender of last resort. But I will say this, from my reading and my data, folks are the happiest when they have good job. They're bringing home paychecks and really working for their family. And, you know, nowadays you have two earner families, which I think is great. And it is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's always been a key part of my own spirit, you know, my own thinking. It's no fun to go through difficult recessions, and it's a lot of fun to be around in prosperities.
Actually, I got it right here. Clearly, economic growth is not worthy only because of its material benefits. It is a sign that humanity is functioning at its highest level.
Right.
I absolutely love that. But you also write, look, meaningful work, the spacious homes, the cars, the vacations, the opportunities that the average inhabitant of this country had, as a matter of course, throughout much of the 20th century was unparalleled. Great stuff. But you actually, I guess this was written just before Trump came into office, right?
Yes. It was published in, I think, September 2016.
And this is almost a roadmap. I mean, you're identifying all of the issues, the frustrations that were being felt by working men and women in America that they weren't getting ahead anymore.
Yes. I mean, I think one of the reasons for the success, I mean, President Trump will go down in history as an exceedingly important president, a very serious president, what I call a consequential president. And when he came in, and putting the policies aside, I mean, he slashed taxes and regulations and so forth, but he spurred the animal spirits, the entrepreneurial spirits. He provided leadership. He said, we're going to have an optimistic future. You know, I learned about optimism from Ronald Reagan, and that was 40 years ago when I worked for him, and I've never lost that. President Trump is the same way. He wants to chart an optimistic future so that his philosophy, he doesn't punish success. He rewards success as any businessman would or businesswoman. That's a big difference from, I don't want to get partisan here, but from, let's say, other administrations. He wants to reward hard work and success. And other want to punish it. That's crazy. America, the greatest democracy in history, and America, the greatest creator of opportunities in history. No other country, even today, has the access to greater opportunities. What John F. Kennedy and later Ronald Reagan and actually Jack Kemp and others of us, a rising tide lifts all boats. I don't want to take boats down, Greg. I want to lift boats up. I want to lift people up. And that's a big principle that President Trump holds. I'm not sure people always understand that. Washington, you know, the political class is always talking about tax the rich and they don't deserve it and they don't pay their fair share. Nonsense. We should applaud the success because those folks create millions and millions of jobs for middle class and lower class, lower income families. And one of the great parts about POTUS's first 3 years before the pandemic, and the data show this clearly, and we use this in the campaign. I talk about this all the time. Those people who benefited from Trump policies, taxes and regulations, were the neediest. They needed it the most. It was not the rich. The rich benefited, which is great. But in statistical terms, the increase in middle class family income, the increase in lower income wages lifted all those people. And they were the biggest beneficiaries. We campaigned on this in 2016, the business tax cuts, the individual tax cuts. I saw it with Reagan, and I did the history of JFK. It was the middle and lower income rungs of the ladder that did the best. And that's what's so wonderful about America that creates opportunities. Trust me on this. There's a lot of wonderful democracies around the world. Allies of ours and so forth, but there is no country that affords the magnitude of new opportunities than this country does. No other country comes even close to us.
And if Biden does get in, it looks like this is, whether he recognizes it or not, that doesn't seem to be like he's going to be in charge, and it's a borderline radical agenda. But then again, they're talking about some moderate people, Janet Yellen or whatever her name is, for Treasury. Actually, do me a favor. Let's skip that for a moment. I want to run this by you. Here's a concern I have right now. When I go to work every day, the office building is 50 stories tall. There are two offices that are currently occupied. It's on 3rd Avenue and 50th Street, two in the entire building. All of the businesses in the mall downstairs, there's this like this this mezzanine with shops. They're all closed. For 6 months now, we've been developing all these new habits, my wife and I. You know, we're not going to the movies. We learned how to cook. You know, we're doing all these things that I think once we open up again, we're not going to live the life that we previously had. We're more thrifty. And I'm worried a little bit about habits that have formed and that they could really hurt people. Some of the habits that people have developed all over the place. I mean, you know what I'm trying to say here. There are a lot of folks who have been permanently affected by this, the shops, businesses that are not coming back. And I feel like the shoe has not fallen, publicly at least, like what this is ultimately going to mean. You have any thoughts on that? Am I crazy?
No, certainly not. But I have a somewhat different view of all this. I mean, this has been a very difficult year, and you know, these things come along literally once every 100 years. So I get that, and I understand the hardship, and I understand the heartbreak. I think everybody's had a hard time. Affluent people have had a hard time, but non-affluent people and people near the bottom rungs have had a very difficult time. I mean, all the prosperity of the prior 3 years almost evaporated because of this COVID pandemic. But I'm going to say this, Greg. I liken this not so much to a Great Depression or a financial meltdown. I see this more as a once-in-a-100-year natural catastrophe, which is not permanent. It does enormous damage. I don't want to downplay that, but it will be conquered. Now, it's funny, yesterday's jobs numbers, everybody's bad-mouthing the economy, which is not true. It's a terrific recovery. Maybe we can get to that later. But the point I want to make is, working with the brilliant private sector, pharmaceutical and biotech companies, the, you know, I call them drugstore companies, CVS, Walgreens, and so forth. And of course, lots of government assistance, Operation Warp Speed. We spent billions of dollars to help these firms research and develop vaccines. Well, therapies and vaccines. You know, we have very good therapies right now, but the vaccine is coming literally in the middle of the month, a couple weeks. A lot of news stories this morning discussing FDA Commissioner Steve Hahn, who was out and about in the media and had met with the president. I sit on the vice president's COVID task force. I've been, you know, going to meetings for 6-7 months, never miss them. The vaccine is coming in rapid speed. And I noticed this morning some of the numbers were moved up a little bit. So we'll probably have 20 million vaccines this month, Greg. We'll have at least 20 million more, probably 30 million more next month. And I noticed one of the scientists, health scientists, said now by late March, we will have 100 million vaccines. Now, I say that, I'm not going to politics here. I'm going a different way. I'm saying that once we get the vaccines in place, help is on the way. We will return, I believe, we will return to normalcy. We will. This is an outlier. It's the once in a 100-year pandemic. And we have gone after it as best we can. And now we're coming down the home stretch. Some people criticize the president for saying things like that, but The fact remains. I mean, I can tell you from these meetings, the military has set up a phenomenal distribution system. This stuff will get out to all 50 states in the beginning, before this month is over, Greg. And then it will, you know, trickle down. You start out with your frontline health workers and first responders, and then you go to the elderly and the nursing homes and assisted living homes, or people who have prior conditions. But it will go out, and it will go out fast. And so therefore, I'm going to make a case that, presuming we still have the right policies for growth, prosperity, jobs, and so forth, we have to fight hard to keep the businesses open. We have to fight hard to keep the schools open, and we will return to normalcy. And you know what? Historically, in this country, normalcy means prosperity. We go through our downturns, absolutely. Markets adjust, occasionally displacements occur. But for this country, normalcy means safe, increasingly healthy, you know, we live much longer, and prosperity with job opportunities. So I think your building will fill up. I don't want to predict it. I myself am coming home to New York in a few weeks to resume my career there. And I know the city will recover. Right now it's suffering from some pretty bad management, but I believe that will be solved too. You and I have both seen, and your dad is such a wonderful man. We've all seen the ups and downs in New York, but I think it'll come back. And so I know how hard it is now, but I don't fret so much about the, you know, the future. I just don't. Maybe that's just me. You know, I have, you know, I live by faith, and I also am a generic optimist, but I really think we will return to normal. And I think that's going to be terrific. And I think it's going to happen faster than nearly everybody thinks.
I love it. It makes total sense to me. You've convinced me, and sorry for my bout of pessimism there. And no, I think you're right from my very amateur's perspective, and I think you're right. Let me ask you this. And I think, by the way, you guys have not gotten nearly the credit you deserve for basically rescuing America. I mean, you know, after the shutdown, the initial aid packages that were engineered by this White House, by the Treasury, I guess in cooperation with Congress. I mean, I remember Ben Stein saying that you guys saved civilization. Maybe he was overstating it, but are you proud of that? I mean, and do
yes.
you feel like you have, and he's right. I mean, you guys have not yes. received sufficient credit for that.
Ben Stein's a longtime friend of mine. I might add, his father, Herb Stein, was a mentor of mine, brilliant economic professor with a distinguished career in government. But yes, things are so polarized down here in Washington. As you know, this has been a big political season, election season, and so forth. But historians will look back and they will see that in 6 or 7 months, the Trump administration, working with Congress most of the time, working with the private sector. See, that's a really key ingredient. Working with the private sector and tapping into the genius and creativity of the private sector. We set up an infrastructure virtually overnight. And whether it was testing or equipment or rescue packages, therapies, vaccines, I've never seen anything like it. Never. The president may not get credit for this for years, but he will ultimately get credit when people look back on what he has done. And again, it's not alone. Most of the time we worked with Congress pretty well. Not recently, I get that, but most of the time. Importantly, we work with the private sector. I mean, we were working in the White House. We were for about 3-4 months. About 4 months, we were literally 24/7. It's very difficult. But then I thought about that, Greg, and I said, you know what? We're doing our job, but you know, there's tens and tens and tens of millions of Americans who have also had an extremely difficult time. Indeed, much, if not most, of this country has had a very difficult time. So I'm not taking any credit. We're all doing our job. That's what's so great about this country. We put our shoulder to the grindstone and we will get through this. But people will look back. I mean, to have a vaccine for what was an unknown virus, and we still don't know everything about this virus, but to have a vaccine developed in 6 months, I mean, come on. Those kinds of medical breakthroughs generally take 10 to 20 years, 6 months. And we will save innumerable lives, not to speak of the economy itself. I just think that's a remarkable achievement. And I don't want to go political. I'm just saying that the country essentially worked together. Maybe not always. I mean, look, you know, Mike Pence will tell you, if you haven't had him on your show, you ought to, but he's a wonderful man, very dear friend of mine, Vice President Pence, who ran this task force. So one of his big jobs was, you know, liaising with the governors. Okay, now the governors, I think the majority of governors today are Republican, but there are a whole lot of Democratic governors, and we worked well with them. They will tell you that. Guys like Phil Murphy of New Jersey, for example. Or even Gavin Newsom of California. We've had our disagreements, but Gavin is a good fella. I've known him for years. We worked well with him. Democrat governors, Republican governors, mayors, this was an emergency. America does come together. It ain't perfect. These things never are. And I know this was a political season, but we are coming out of this. I mean, I'm going to tell you, 60% of the people who lost their jobs have come back to work. Okay. That's 6 months later. The economy itself, I coined the phrase V-shaped recovery. The president bought into it. Yesterday's jobs report was not near as bad as people made it out to be. But yes, I think it was a bit disappointing. And I think the spike in the pandemic has probably held some things back. But we are in a housing boom, we are in an automobile boom. Businesses are now investing in plants and equipment for the first time. We're seeing tremendous numbers there. New business applications, new business startups, which in some sense is the heart of the economy, are soaring. I mean, soaring. My pal, Ed Hyman, who is one of the best economists in Wall Street decades, he has this wonderful survey. It's a Christmas tree survey. You got to love this. He has his staff go out and they get on the phone to a whole bunch of Christmas tree dealers across the country. You got to love this. And Christmas trees are being sold at a 29% above a year ago. 29% above a year ago. And a year ago, you recall, was pre-pandemic. So Christmas tree sales for the Christmas season soaring, along with these other areas. We're going to get some hard knocks in the holiday season. The virus is going to continue to spike for a while. That's why people must, and I want to repeat this, they must maintain the guidelines of masking and distancing and hygiene. They must. But help is on the way with the pandemic, and we've put together rescue packages and vaccine packages and, you know, respirators, ventilators, gowns, gloves, masks. That stuff went out within, you know, a couple of months. And so I understand the political season, but I'm telling you, objectively, this was the most remarkable operation. And yes, I am proud to have been a part of this. Yes.
So I want to respect your time. I've got just two areas that I want to cover briefly. You mentioned the job numbers. We'll get to that. Also, I do want to find out a little bit about your life before all of this. But just one quick observation, and tell me if I'm onto something here. You talked about how well the coronavirus task force in the White House worked, you know, with the private sector and other areas. Is part of that because you're do have experience in government, but most of it is in the private sector? The president came from the private sector. A lot of people at the Treasury Department came from the private sector. I mean, you've got government officials and people with long time tenures in DC. But it strikes me from the outside looking in that you are unusually, there's an unusual number of people from the private sector who really yes. excelled, and that's helping things in a big way.
Absolutely. It's a key point. Led by the president. And by the way, we work the private sector in many other areas, apart from the pandemic or before the pandemic hit. But yes, absolutely. Look, my great friend Steve Mnuchin over at Treasury was the private sector business financial guy. My background is private sector. Well, I've actually served several times in government. But in essence, whether I worked on Wall Street or when I was a CNBC anchor, we were covering the financial and business beat. Alex Azar, the health secretary, had long experience in government, but also long experience in the pharmaceutical industry. He was an expert. Wilbur Ross over at Commerce, one of the most brilliant bankers in this country for many, many, many years. So you go down the list and you see those were our instincts. In the White House, Jared, same thing. Always, leaning towards the private sector. Jared set up a tremendous overnight infrastructure, not only for the PPP equipment and the testing stuff, but also the Operation Warp Speed. And we brought in other people to run Warp Speed, which is essentially a government-private operation. It goes back, Greg, it goes back to the point I made earlier. The president and his top people, we respect the free enterprise economy. We know that's what drives inventions and innovations and companies and jobs and incomes. We respect it. We don't punish success. We reward success. Those are the instincts of this administration. Kushner, Kudlow, everybody, you go up and down the line. Ivanka Trump, the same way. As I said, Steven Mnuchin and I, you'll never find an administration with an NEC, National Economic Council Director, and the Treasury Secretary more in sync and working together. We don't play the little games that often happen in Washington. We always work together with Wilbur Ross. So a lot of us have known each other for many years before we came down for this. We were friends and we shared similar values. But the president led this. And you bet, business is so important. That's why, it is my great hope. All right, I'm going to be a little political here, but it is my great hope that the GOP maintains its advantage in the Senate. They've made great strides in the House, regardless of whether, naturally I want the president to win, but whatever goes there, we must protect the successes. We must protect the positive consequences of this administration. We must protect the idea of growth and prosperity and opportunity and the importance of the free enterprise economy. I don't want the government to run the economy. I want the government to be a partner, maybe a limited partner. Yeah. But we know our bread is buttered literally by free enterprise, and we got to preserve that. And I fear that many, many on the other team just will try to knock that down.
They look like a business as usual crowd in the worst way, government business as usual. There's a guy named Justin Muzenich. I'm sure you cross paths with
yes.
him.
Yes. Yeah, oh, I love him. Love him.
Me
He's
too.
Wonderful.
We have a mutual
wonderful.
Friend here in New York. So, Larry, you mentioned the job numbers. The numbers, let's see, U.S. employers added 245,000 jobs in November. The headlines, very, very bleak, as you know. Let's see, the New York Times unemployment report without silver linings. You've been pretty clear that this is the wrong take. Not exactly fantastic news, but these headlines are missing the point somehow.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the economy is much better than the jobs report would suggest. That's just sort of, to me, that's the lead story here. But look, one thing they ignored, I mean, first of all, the unemployment rate fell to 6.7%. That's remarkable. All the institutions, the Federal Reserve and the Congressional Budget Office and others, didn't expect single digits unemployment until 2021. All right, we got them starting 3 months ago, and it's gone from 14.7 to 6.7. And Greg, the biggest reductions of unemployment, get this, the biggest drops of unemployment were the minority groups, African Americans, Asians, Hispanics. And women are not a minority group. Women are a majority group. But they had, that category had a huge decline in unemployment. And they're all saying, well, people have dropped out of the labor force. Well, some did, yes. And the spikes up in the virus probably restrained the economy. We'll know more in December about that. But private workforce increased by 484,000. That's a big number. That's the private sector, okay? And nobody wants to acknowledge that. The stock market is booming, and you know, we talked earlier about housing and autos and business investment and so forth, new business applications. I love that. And of course, the Christmas tree index rising 29%. So I'm just saying, for some reason, the media wants to badmouth our economy. I suppose that's politics. But nonetheless, it's not true. You know, so much of these arguments, I mean, I just love this, is that we were talking earlier, family incomes on Trump did best in the middle and lower income classes. So much in Washington, and these debates, Greg, are fact-free. They're fact-free debates. And that's not good. It's important to do your homework and look at the facts.
You know, it's wild. Why is this happening now? Why are the media the way they are? And sometimes, look, I'm no better. It's interesting. I read an article about you in the 90s. Actually, I found it this morning, but I remember where I was when I read it. I was in Meridian, Mississippi, and because I remember this part. I'm going to read it. This is from the New York Times profile about you. He had no extensive formal training in economics, but he did have an innate understanding of how markets worked and was comfortable with numbers, and he worked hard to teach himself. I want to ask you about that in and of itself, but it's just so wild. I can't remember things I read, you know, 2 hours ago, but I remember this story, and I remember newspaper articles that I read in the 90s, and I think part of it was we were not constantly inundated with information. People weren't churning out information the way they are today, and when you're putting so much stuff out, it's easy to do without a lot of thought. I'm kind of fascinated with where we are right now in this media culture and why things don't seem to resonate the way they used to. But I don't know if that makes sense to you.
I recall that article, and that's actually a pretty good article. The author of that article was Sylvia Nasser, who's a very, very bright woman. Wrote a great book about a Nobel Prize winner named Nash.
A beautiful mind, right?
That's correct. That's exactly right. Russell Crowe played the leaves, and it's a true story. But look, you're very kind to raise that. I had some formal training. I mean, I went to Princeton Graduate School for public policy and took graduate level economic courses, but I do not have a PhD. I worked at the Federal Reserve for 3 years and learned a lot of economics. But most of my work is a sort of what I would call on the ground as a practitioner. I have a good head for figures, thankfully. And I understand markets, and I've had a lot of experience. I was a Wall Street economist at Bear Stearns, and the old Payne Weber. And I worked in OMB as the economist in the Reagan years. And then I covered the economics beat for CNBC. I had my own show, and I co-hosted with my great pal, Jim Cramer. And you cover the news every night. I mean, I was on every night for about 15 years. Sometimes I had two shows during the day. So you learn, okay? You learn. Is it self-taught? I'm happy with that appellation. I've had some professional help, but you just learn. You have experience. I'm not putting down academics, because some of them are very brilliant and they inform us and they make things better. But I'm more of a practitioner on the ground. And I think I've learned down through the years, and that Kennedy book was about this to some extent, throughout American history, throughout American economic history, with great clarity, we learned that some policies work and some policies don't work. Now, in our great democracy, we fight this out every 4 years at the presidential level. But I think I understand what works and what doesn't work. And that's guided me. And with a good sense of optimism, and as I said earlier, faith is a big part of my life. So that's my core, Greg. You're very kind to point that out. I appreciate it.
No. Well, to both that, it was very impressive, and it just left an impact because I remembered you. I mean, in the 90s, we had stars. There are so many celebrities now that celebrity almost doesn't mean anything. And you became famous when people were paying attention in a way that they're not paying attention today. And by the way, I think the first time I ever encountered you, or not encountered you, but saw you, were you on the McLaughlin Group as a guest back then?
Yes. I'm for several years, I was kind of a regular irregular. I'd be on once or twice a month. John McLaughlin was very kind to me, and he did make me a visible person. And I used to love that show. It's all changed now. John's passed away. But yes, I did the McLaughlin Group a lot.
Well, it was
I started out, it's funny, I bump into Robin McNeil here in Washington every now and then. It was the McNeil-Lehrer Report in the late 70s that I was like the first economics commentator, because the economy was falling apart. How they found me, I'll never know. And then I did the early CNN stuff, and then I did all the CNBC stuff. And I'm not going to tell you specifics, but I intend to go back into TV and radio within the next couple of months, certainly.
Robin McNeil, by the way, is alive, and he's 89 years old.
I'm sorry. It's Jim Lehrer.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Jim
Robin,
Lehrer.
Yeah, Jim Lehrer. I beg your pardon. McNeil Lehrer was perhaps the most famous TV news, or Huntley Brinkley, but I meant Jim Lehrer, who's still around, has a beautiful home in Washington, D.C. He did a book party for Alan Greenspan couple of years ago, and my great friend Kevin Hassett, who was the CEA chair for a couple of years under Trump, brought me to the book party. Greenspan is an old and dear personal friend. Anyway, Robin, I hadn't seen him, I don't know how long, came right up to me, congratulated me on my appointment to the White House, and he said, "We gave you your start." And you know what? He was right.
Well, if they didn't give you your start, somebody else was going to, because, I mean, I knew right away, and I was in high school, this guy is a star. There is something very special about you. You've got great charisma. You know what I'm talking about. And
you're very kind.
Well,
it's
true.
You're
it wasn't
way too kind.
It wasn't like you got a lucky break. Let's just put it that way. So I've had you.
Look, Greg, you've made a great success of your career. You're having a comeback now. You did great on Fox. Now you got Newsmax, which is owned by my pal Chris Reddy, or run by Chris Reddy. He's a very dear friend of mine. You guys are hot as a pistol, and I'm told you have the highest rated show on Newsmax.
It's true.
Very cool.
It's
very
true.
Cool.
Thank you very much. In fact,
I told you were going to snap back a couple of years ago.
You sure did. You know, the New York, the Washington Post called my show the hottest show in cable right now. No kidding. They did an extensive profile on another talented broadcaster, Shepard Smith, who's suffering in the ratings, and they said the hottest show right now is. I couldn't believe it. But I'll tell you this, as we wrap up here, because I would like to talk about your faith, your core, as we go to break, as we end the show, but. I could not have done it without God, without having a relationship with Him, which I only, quite frankly, achieved over the past, I'd say, 5 years, maybe a little less. I was kind of going about my business in a very selfish way, totally in line with how society says you should live. Started reading the Bible, and it was like getting acquainted with a friend, a neighbor who happens to be the most powerful force in the universe, the force of the universe. And so that's how I got to where I am. You've mentioned a couple of times your faith is your core. I'm imagining from your biography that it hasn't always been the case, but it certainly is now. Could you tell us anything you feel like telling us about that?
Well, yeah, sure. Look, I've occasionally been public about all this. I had a huge crash and burn in the mid 90s, 94, 95, and was kind of a hopeless alcohol and drug abuser. Vodka and cocaine were my downfall. And that article you cited from the New York Times was the first public statement I ever made on it. It was a big article. Well done by the Times, by the way. I went through bloody hell and lost pretty much everything. I'm married to a saint, I might add, Judy Kudlow, Judith Pond Kudlow, who's a great artist, I might add, painter in her own right. She stayed with me and sent me away to a recovery place in northern Minnesota. I was up there for 5 or 6 months and had very good counseling and came into contact with Alcoholics Anonymous and the Big Book, which is a spiritual transformation book. It's not a religious program, but God plays a big role. God is the higher power. You know, I learned painfully, as did other millions of people. It's nothing special. Lots of millions of people have gone through this successfully. You know, I had to curb myself, restrain myself, and learn that I am not all powerful. And, you know, there is one who has power. That one is God. May you find him now. That's a quote from the Big Book. And I came to faith. Took a while, you know. I've been sober and clean for 25 years with God's grace. If I get through to July 1st this year, this coming year, it'll be 26 years. And it just changed my life. I came to faith. And today, I'm certainly not ashamed of this. I'm proud of it. But God plays a role in my life every day. I do my morning meditations and prayers. When there's some tough things happening, you know, the last 3 years in politics and the White House and government and the presidency and the media, you get whacked sometimes, Greg, but I fall back on my faith and I pray and I talk to a lot of people. You know, I take advice from smart, sober people. I don't make decisions alone anymore. And that's a huge change for me. You know, I was kind of a Wall Street high flyer when all this happened. So it may be the best thing that ever happened to me. I wouldn't have wished it, but when I look back on it, it caused an incredible change in my life and my behavior and my thinking and my faith. And I would say to folks who may be listening to this, first of all, if I got sober, you all can get sober, because I was hopeless. And second of all, think about faith. Think about letting God into your life. I'm not a preacher. I'm not a minister. I'm not a proselytizer. I'll just say it worked for me. And for folks who may be listening in, if you're having hard times, be open to it. Be open to the Lord. You'd be surprised what can happen. I certainly would never have been assistant to the president and director of the National Economic Council had I not gotten sober had I not been sober all these years. My life was over 25 years ago. Now it's back, and I'm thankful for it. I'm totally thankful for it. The grace of God is one of the most remarkable things, maybe the most remarkable thing in my life. And I say it personally. I don't say it as an expert. I'm not. I'm not an addiction expert. I'm just one guy who got creamed and was able to come back and climb the ladder. And it informs everything I do, Greg, literally everything I do.
I love it. I love it. Larry Kudlow, thank you very much.
My great pleasure. Thank you. Honored to be here.
He's a really great guy. so impressive. And I'm kind of impressed with myself that I know him. Really like him. And I hope you enjoyed that. Folks, thank you for listening. And if you don't mind, you'd be doing me a huge favor. Check out the go ahead and rate us if you would, whatever you think we're worth, and 5 stars most likely, right? And send us an email, subscribe, all that stuff. And you can follow me at Greg Kelly USA on Twitter, same on Instagram, and the Newsmax show is on at 7 o'clock East Coast time. And as I tell you all these things to do for me, what can I do for you? You know, we were talking to Larry for a little bit about his life and faith. If there's one piece of advice, you know, I heard this podcast with Tim Ferriss, who's a great guy. I met him once years ago. He talked about, it's a question that he asks a lot of his guests, what advice would you give your 17-year-old self? And I think it's a pretty intriguing question. I mean, it's kind of useless at the same time. You know, you can't go back. And for a long time, I think I would have said I would have saved money. I would have studied harder in college, stuff like that. But the advice I would give anybody, and not to my 17-year-old self, or anyone, I think that is kind of, you know, you get the point of the question. If you don't have a relationship with God, I urge you to start one. He is available to all of us at any time, and he wants to have a relationship with you. I did not know that until fairly recently in my life, over the past couple of years. And the gateway to this relationship is the Bible. It is the most powerful document. It's magic. It's divine. And it's a way to communicate with him. And the power that comes from that is the greatest thing in the universe. I'll talk more about that in detail and just my journey, which I wouldn't change a thing, quite frankly. I wouldn't change a thing. Lots of bumps along the way. But, you know, that's... we're all on a journey, and most of us realize that any adversity we've ever gone through is for a purpose. It's one of the big takeaways from reading the Bible, and it's full of examples of that, that when you go through tough times, it's an opportunity for growth, and God will sometimes put us in tough circumstances to bring us closer to Him. So that's what advice I would give any human being, no matter what their age. Thank you very, very much, and to be continued.